My name is Irene Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast Neue Musik Leben. This is usually a German podcast, but once in a while and sometimes even more often I do English episodes. And I love doing English episodes. I have studied classical singing and music, but I love to sing contemporary experimental new music. And if you would like to know more about me, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. I will put this into the show notes. And in this podcast, I talk about topics all around contemporary experimental music. I share with you behind the scenes, insider knowledge, and I really want to bring you the human beings out of the new music world much closer to you. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, which is a very important German paper about, music, about all topics of music. I'm also always very thankful when you email me and contact me. I get lovely, lovely messages from all over the world. And that makes me very happy and also motivates me to continue with this podcast. Now I have a little series for you because, last year I was supposed to travel to Great Britain and I love traveling to Great Britain. I was invited to sing in Oxford and, we all know what happened. COVID-19 came and all these things were cancelled. So far I could not travel to Great Britain and work with my wonderful colleagues there. And now it's almost a year that we have this coronavirus in this world and with all the regulations and things that come along with it. And so I was thinking so much about being with my colleagues, working with them. And I was really also curious to know how they are doing. And this is how I came up to make this little series with four wonderful colleagues. And they are composers, James Weeks, James Saunders and Tim Parkinson. And I'm also very happy to have as a guest in my show Juliet Fraser, who also is a soprano singer. And she is a colleague I admire very much. And so I'm very happy that she also is in my show. Today we start with a composer, James Weeks.
Hello, James. Hello, James Weeks. I welcome you into my podcast, Neue Musik Leben.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And the first question I always ask is, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Oh, I think it was a natural inclination from a very early age in my case. I had an amazingly special musical education for which I'm eternally grateful. We have this a system in the UK of cathedral choirs and cathedral schools, and it's still the case that you can go and become a boarding pupil at a cathedral school at the age of 7 or 8, and that's what I did. And so I sang in this amazing choir in Oxford for 5 or 6 years, from when I was 7 to when I was 12. And that laid the foundations for my whole musical life, really. I come from a musical family as well. But in terms of new music, I think I always found composing exciting. I started writing music when I was 5 or 6, or at least my mum, who's a pianist, used to write it down for me. And I wrote, I wrote for my school orchestra and my school choir, and I loved all the music that we performed that was contemporary or at least 20th century, and that just continued through my teens. You know, when you have your sort of artistic and personal awakening, and one of my main awakenings was to love contemporary music in a big way. So first I I played the organ, so I loved the music of Messiaen, and I played a lot of that. And then the father of a school friend of mine is a famous music critic, and he used to invite me over to listen to his amazing CD collection. And he's taking me to concerts of London Sinfonietta, playing the latest, you know, new music from Europe and America. I had a piano teacher who encouraged this a lot as well. And eventually my school found me the perfect teacher, who was Michael Finnessy. I spent quite a lot of time in my late teens working with Michael. And after that, I never looked back. And at the same time, I had this sort of twin passion of conducting, which I was also developing at the same time. So everything kind of went hand in hand, really. And I knew from a really early age that that's what I wanted to be, a composer, rather. And I just followed it through all the way.
That's cool if it's so laid out for you. And I mean, it's also interesting you then established a choir or a vocal ensemble, Ex Audi, where you can bring all those talents together that you're composing, you're singing, and you're conducting. I mean, that's really great. And also, when I worked with you, you could always demonstrate things for me, and I really appreciate that, because that helps so much. I mean, I don't expect that a composer has to sing it, you know, perfectly beautifully, but you get an idea if somebody can demonstrate it, and that I always liked that when working with you.
I love being a performer and a composer at the same time. I know as a performer how reassuring it is, as you've just said, when the composer can come and sing to you what they want. They can maybe, as you say, I mean, I've got, it's funny because all of my music making really came from being a singer, I think. But I have a terrible voice and I can't sing nicely at all. So I was never going to be a professional singer, but I got as close as I possibly could. I as you say, I started a vocal ensemble. But yeah, when a composer comes to you and they can't sing a note of it, and they can't explain the rhythm clearly, or they can't seem to pitch in an interval, it's very demoralizing, I think, for a performer, because you begin to wonder, you know, what their ear is and what their musicianship is. And it's so yeah, I mean, I love the fact that that, you know, one can have these dual roles and so on. Yeah, and you're right that the Ex Audi, which is my vocal ensemble, allows me to do all of the things that I love almost simultaneously. And we don't always do pieces by me, of course. You know, we do all sorts of music, but we have done quite a lot of my pieces, and that's a special pleasure and a special joy.
Yeah, but that you also can communicate differently than with the composers if you, you know, do other contemporary music. And I really like the sound of your ensemble, and we will definitely put also some links about it into the show notes. What represents good new music for you?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, that is a very difficult question. Well, it's definitely not something to do with a particular style. I think we can definitely say that to begin with. For me, there has to be a searching quality to the music, an exploratory quality, so that the music seems alive, and in a sense that the composer is not, well, I mean, hopefully by the time you hear the music, the composer is sure, you know, what they're trying to do. But there's a sense that in the process of listening, you're going on a journey and exploring something, something new and fresh. So that's extremely important to me. And I feel I've got a very strong antenna for music which is simply fitting into other people's styles, or, you know, a conventional style. I'm not really interested in common practice. I'm not that interested in composers who aren't trying to make those quite courageous explorations into the unknown. For me, if music has that searching quality, that questing, exploring quality, I think that would be the first thing that I want to hear. Also, for me, I think a quality of candor, by which I mean a sort of honesty or sincerity about the music is very important. It's difficult to explain exactly where that exists. I can't extract it from a piece of bottle and say, you know, sprinkle some sincerity onto your music and it'll sound great. That's not really work. It comes deeply from a personality and their outlook. Dare we even say morality as well? You know, it's an old-fashioned concept. But so I think these things I instantly key into in a piece of music, and I'm fascinated by. But the surface and the subject matter of the music could be anything. I mean, you love all sorts of different things.
And I know that you have been teaching for quite a while. You have a professorship, and so are those also the qualities you support your students to bring out?
Yeah, so I've been teaching composers at university level for a long time. Before my current position in Durham University, I was teaching at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama in London, which is one of the main conservatoires in London. So I've done a lot of work with people of age 18 to 25. Yes, of course it is, but of course there are lots of things you have to do for your students, and a lot of things that you have to help them to find for themselves. I mean, obviously, everything that they become as a composer, they have to find themselves. That's really, really important. So you're not just imposing your idea of what music is on them. In a kind of literal stylistic way. And I've watched some very famous people at close quarters, famous composers on summer courses that, you know, ex-Audi has tutored on. I've watched them try to do exactly that, that they have said, this is the future of music. You must write in my way. You must listen to everything I say, and you must follow that path. That is completely not my way at all. So you're trying to, in a very basic level, I think there are certain types of skills which you can literally just teach them. They're transferable skills. They're technical as much as anything. And they can either use them or discard them as they wish. But, you know, that's a kind of specific thing which you can use as the sort of the basis of your day-to-day interactions with your students. Then you're trying to get them to think like a composer, to make the kind of imaginative leaps that are going to create interesting questions that they can then explore in music. But even more than that, I think it's really, really important that, and especially as your students get older and you're maybe working with postgraduates, that what you're trying to do is also show them an ethos, a way of life as an artist, as a composer, of course, but also as a human being to some extent. And again, it's not a question of saying, be exactly like me, or, you know, that's wrong. That's of course not right, you know, and you know, I'm full of doubts about everything about myself, as we all are. And that's, you know, that's one of the things actually that, you know, that one learns to live with as you get older. And that's something that they need also to have the courage to confront. But if you can be there for them as a kind of mentor, as they take their first steps in a very, very holistic way. I think that's very important. And so it may not always be about the notes. It might also be about how to live, you know, how to get through from day to day, how to deal with, you know, structuring the time that you have to work or don't have to work, how your life ends up in your work. So I think it is a very holistic thing, as well as a very specific and technical thing.
I find it very fascinating how composition can be, and sometimes, even though I don't see myself as a composer, I mean, I'm a singer, but sometimes I wish I would have also had lessons like that, where you really get also the space to learn about yourself, because I have the feeling back in my studies, it was all about the voice and more about functioning, and a lot of those things you just talked about, I found out later in my life, and I felt like there was no support on in those areas.
Right, and interesting, because I think singers, and of course I work with singers all the time, and I have a group of singers that form my ensemble who I'm very, very close to, and we know each other very well. And I'm also aware that with some of them, I am one of a number of people that they use as kind of mentors. We've never really talked about this, you know, in the ensemble, but obviously the fact that I constantly come back to them and give them more and more work, and, you know, a certain sense of loyalty builds up between us. And I find myself sometimes having the sorts of conversations that you've just talked about with them. Now, what strikes me about what you've just said is that singers in particular ought to be given this kind of mentorship and help, because to build your life and your career and indeed your income on something which is fundamentally quite, well, fundamentally a part of you to mm-hmm. begin with. So it's bodily and functionally a part of you. It's incredibly closely allied to your sense of self, and your self-image, your identity. And it's also fragile and vulnerable, as the body is. So the mind is, and the body is, you know, and they're all, they're the same thing, really. And the voice is all bound up in that. And so if you go through your entire singing tuition without having any help with how to deal with your life as a singer, or your identity as a singer and your life being a singer, and all of those things. And I think that's shocking. I'm shocked to hear that you didn't have that support, and I'm sorry. And I hope that, I mean, maybe it's the same now in conservatoires in Europe and the UK and everywhere now. Maybe they still don't, but I do hope it's better. You know,
I hope so too. I don't know. I talked also with some instrumentalists, and they also didn't have that. I mean, I don't know if it's changing now. I will maybe research on that.
My guess. It would be really interesting to know, wouldn't it? My guess is that. You know, in my experience with conservatoires is that there's an old guard of famous teachers who don't want to change anything, but that younger or just people who are more au fait with this kind of zeitgeist, as we call it in English, tend to be much more aware of these things. Mm-hmm. They're much more aware of the importance of mind, body, and spirit, and you know, what we constantly just refer to as mental health nowadays, mm-hmm. which is now expanded to mean, you know, general sort of feelings and morale for life.
So I just realized all that, you know, doing this podcast, and when I have guests here who are like you teaching at a university level, and they tell me what they do, then I'm like, whoa, that sounds so great. I didn't have that. And so I will really think on that. It's a great topic. And I mean, even now, we are now in this corona pandemic where it's even more important that you feel somehow good with yourself. Otherwise, you go crazy in those times.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think even the strongest amongst us are suffering from time to time, just because it's going on and on and on and on. And just as you think you've turned the corner and everything's going to be okay again, we get another lockdown. So, I don't think it's easy for anybody. And new difficulties arise the whole time. It's extraordinarily important. And no doubt other people have said as well that we are all super aware in higher education now about our students' well-being. Although we're obviously not trained to deal with it, we certainly are given strong pointers in you know how to deal with the students that struggling, where to find help for them, how to deal with that. So it's becoming a bigger and bigger part of the job. And you know, there's always a bit of pushback when you have to remember that students have to stand on their own two feet in the end, and they have to strengthen themselves. There is an element of needing to toughen up, but at the same time, we live in difficult times. I mean, even without coronavirus, I think that, you know, the times are very difficult. They certainly are in the UK. I was just reading something this morning, a poet giving voice to this sense that we have in our age that something is badly wrong. And the thing that we all know is badly wrong is the environment, the climate, the natural world. I think the underlying panic of our species, if you like, is that we either secretly or not so secretly know that things are going badly, and that the world as we know it isn't going to continue in this way for very much longer. And even my own children, you know, who are 9 and 6, are going to face a very different future. There's this kind of underlying uncertainty, as if we're suddenly aware that we're living on not a solid ground, but a boat which is rocking quite appreciably, and we don't feel balanced all the time. So it's interesting also that a lot of contemporary art, a lot of music that I'm coming across, and a lot of music that I know you know and that we've collaborated on, the music of Vandelweiser and associated composers, of which there are now hundreds, I would say. You know, I mean, it's a it, and a reason. The reason it's that kind of work is so prevalent is that I think it responds to a very basic need of our time, to find calm and space and a kind of meditative wholeness, which is not being provided elsewhere. And so the art of our time, I think, is in tending more and more towards these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those uncertainties, I mean, they can frighten you, but also in a way I think they open up new rooms and options, and that's also very fascinating to observe and also to live myself and see that I maybe also do things I didn't think maybe a year ago I wouldn't do. And I guess that's probably the same. I mean, you're probably teaching a lot online with your students, but I mean, life is going on and you do things.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think we're all very much more aware of where we stand and, you know, what's important in our lives than we were a year ago, perhaps. You know, we've been forced to confront ourselves in a different way. And that's, as you say, that's very stimulating. It's very stimulating. And as long as we have remaining the networks to continue to make work and express that as artists, then we're okay. You know, I mean, I, for example, have, as a composer, the pandemic hasn't been too bad, really, because I've been able to catch up on pieces that I wanted to write. And I've also been able to, you know, record a CD recently of chamber music, which I've been, you know, we've been editing and I'm excited about, and that will come out in a month or two. Mm-hmm. And that has sustained me. But I know that my singer colleagues, some of them who have a diverse career have been okay, but others who really rely on their identity as a singer have found it very difficult.
Yes.
Very difficult.
Yes, yes.
Because they don't have an outlet to express the new feelings that we all have at the moment. But I think, you know, if we let it, and if there's still money to be found so that we can actually put projects together, I think artists and composers and performers have an incredibly important role to play in negotiating culture and society mm-hmm. through the next few years. And we need to be given the opportunity and space to do that, I think.
Mm. Yeah. So I would like to know, now we go back to a different topic, what are the qualities you most appreciate in the performers you work with?
Oh, well, I think, of course, I'd have to say open-mindedness. Imagination really is important. There is a certain breed of performer I can't work with, and that's the performer that says, this is what I can do. This is what I know how to do. I'm not up for learning anything new. And I find it challenging and I don't like it, and I'm going to make life difficult. Luckily, I don't come across people like that very often, because, you know, you spend your life avoiding people who are inimical to you and looking for people who are friendly to your way of being. But for example, last year I found myself in a room with a cellist who swore blind that there wasn't, that it was impossible to play a seventh harmonic, a seventh partial on an open G string. So it's a kind of flat G, flat F natural. This is completely ordinary. It's totally standard for a contemporary music mm-hmm. Practice to not only know that the note exists, but also to be able to just find it straight away. But we ended up in a sort of stand-up row about it, and it was really unpleasant. So that's an example of the sort of person I don't like to work with. But luckily I'm surrounded by imaginative and biddable people who want to try new things and are excited by what composers, you know, the places composers can go to in their imagination, and what they can cook up, and what they can extend people's practice into. So people who are very stuck in their own way of working and are basically, I mean, it's partly laziness perhaps in some people, but I think also other people are scared that they'll be so-called outside their comfort zone, and they'll be shown, you know, not to be as good and versatile as their self-image, dictates. But, you need people who aren't brittle like that, who are flexible and confident in themselves. And, of course, they also have to be just absolutely super excellent musicians.
Yes, certainly.
if I want someone to sing a quarter tone, for example, you know, I want them to, as you did, you know, I want them to be able to go there and find it. But having said that, Irena, I would say that, there are different situations, aren't there? Because, you know, when we worked together, it was as if we were extending your practice together somehow, by finding, you know, the way to find new intervals and new ways of hearing. And, be, you know, because you're a, a top-class musician, you were able to do that. But I've also worked quite a lot with amateur musicians, and I've been very, very aware of technical limitations, and I've had to work with them on that. But again, for me, I think the most important thing is that they're imaginative and they're excited about new things.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people who are in this field love new things, because I always like to try out new things and, as you said, leave my comfort zone. I found that back then, the example you mentioned with quarter tones very interesting and helpful, because you were then, we mentioned before, you can sing, you have been singing, and you recorded those intervals for me. And for me, it was so helpful, because for some reason, I noticed when I just hear those quarter tones, like with the electronic sound, I just hear it then, I don't know, maybe more like a coloring, and it's much harder to get. But when I really hear it by another human voice, it was so much easier to find it. And I still find those quarter or microtones challenging. And I always, I mean, we talked about the two, wonder what can we do that people can sing them more easily. Also in this Western world, maybe if you're used a lot to Indian or music like that, you're very used to those notes in between. And how did your discovery go with that? I mean, I'm sure you use it once in a while, and you hear them so well, because your examples were so good and so helpful.
I mean, yeah, I think it is getting used to the sounds. I think that's extremely important. I mean, I've been thinking a lot, and one thing I would love to do, if I could somehow find the research money to do this, I would love to set up a project to work on singers pitching just intonation.
Sounds great. Do it.
That's something I'm really interested in. And, you know, there are some people around the world who are doing it and beginning to do it quite well. But it doesn't really seem to happen in an ensemble context very much. I think it is just going into that world and spending time there, so that you end up being able to do it basically intuitively. In other words, by ear. And the people who, you know, the just intonation people in Berlin, for example, mostly playing string instruments.
Yes.
You know, they spend ages tuning intervals. And, you know, you can get your electronic tuners out and check whether you've got it right. But basically, you're listening to the beating and the purity of intervals under your ear. So it's a different way of listening, fundamentally, or rather it's a more nuanced way of listening, perhaps, than we're used to. And I think it's a great challenge for singers as well, because, you know, if one's singing early music, one should be able to sing quite clearly in Pythagorean tuning, in quarter comma mean tone, or at least to sing along with a keyboard tuned in quarter comma mean tone, and to understand the difference between those things, and also to have spent time tuning, you know, perfect triads and perfect fifths as well, depending on the repertoire. And even for singers who do this music all the time, even that is a bit of unknown territory. You know, this is not part of, we're going back to the whole vocal training question, it's not part of most people's vocal training. And it's a bit crazy, I think. There's a whole world of new research and teaching into how to do this and how to achieve it, which needs to be done. Because otherwise, I think composers are going to leave singers behind.
Mm-hmm.
Because so many composers now, not all, obviously, but I mean, so many composers are interested in clear distinctions between micro intervals, and we don't yet have loads and loads of singers around who are confident with it.
Mm-hmm.
in any way, you know, even in the most basic ways. And this is, you know, it's not their fault. It's just because we need to catch up, I think.
This is
something that I dream about, but as yet, I haven't worked out the way to get all the money that would be required.
Hey, I keep my fingers crossed. I mean, I know when I can sing with an instrument to place it. I mean, I think that's the talent of a singer. I can sing anything that's around me, whatever weird tuning it is, or if it's, how you said, in pure triads or whatever. But to really find it in my brain or whatever, in my system for myself, that's very, very hard.
And that's because we need a theoretical concept in our mind in order to be able to pitch things. You know, I mean, people couldn't just pluck sixths and sevenths out of the air until, you know, we'd invented a stave and a way of representing it visually and a way of theorizing it, with scale theory or tonal theory, so that you can do these things. And and that's where we just haven't got anywhere with it yet. So there's some exciting work to be done, and I guess people are doing it, which I don't know about. Maybe not on much of a scale yet. So
how you practice it with X-Audi when you have those quarter tones? No. Okay.
No, not really. And that's really because we haven't yet dealt with music which requires us to work in that way. Partly because I think composers who are interested in writing that kind of music, for example, Catherine Lamb, haven't yet written big vocal ensemble pieces. There's a big piece by Marc Sabat, which he wrote for Ekmele's ensemble, which they do a really brilliant job. I mean, completely brilliant. And the same ensemble, which is based in New York, also performed a piece of mine, which was written in fifth tones. So, you know, based on a kind of extended vocabulary of the 16th century composer Vicentino. And they performed that. And again, they did a really good job. But, you know, I was there for the rehearsals, and there's no question that we are all feeling our way. We're trying to work out as quickly as we can how to make this as accurate as possible. But I would like to do it more systematically and take a much wider view on this. Because at the moment, what people are mainly doing is listening to MIDI versions of it and then trying to replicate it. And that's fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't really form the basis of a...
No, I don't feel... very happy with it either, and I really wish we could do something more about it, because I also when I hear it or I hear microtones by instruments, I love that sound, and so I'm somehow disappointed with myself that I cannot do them as well, or sometimes I get frustrated, and I really hope we get further on that. Wow, great topic.
Isn't it exciting to think that there are new frontiers that we need to cross artistically and technically? I think it gives you a purpose for the future, which is very exciting.
Certainly. Well, we already heard a lot about you, that you know you're composing, you're teaching, you're conducting, sometimes you're singing. I heard a recording of you, a piece by Christopher Fox. I think you're walking also on that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yes, that's true. Yeah, yeah. I don't think I was really singing in that, but yeah, I was definitely... I love performing. That's the thing.
Using your voice. I think you were more talking or shouting or something, yeah.
I was shouting, yeah, vocalizing.
So how do you round all of those things up? Do you have any kind of time management, and what would you advise us, or what do you tell your students?
I don't know. I mean... I most of my time at the moment seems to be spent with my family. Obviously, at the moment we're teaching the children at home because the schools aren't open. So between my wife and me, we have to manage that. I mean, I'm getting a lot of delight and joy out of teaching them music as well. Sometimes it's frustrating and you know, they don't want to do it, but most of the time they do. And that's really, really great. I mean, honestly, if I had a really good answer to how to juggle all the things that I'm trying to fit into my life, I would give it to you straight away, but I don't. I mean, I think, and everyone I've ever talked to at every stage of their life has said that there is no answer. You'll never find the answer. I'm lucky to have a job which allows me to take sabbaticals every 2 and a bit years. So right at this moment, I'm on sabbatical. So I'm writing music. I'm catching up with writing that I haven't been able to do. It's very difficult and always something is getting squeezed. And I just hope that I sort of get to the end of a period, a year or something, and think, well, I managed to do some of this and some of that and some of the other. And that's all I can hope for, really. But also maybe not to be too prescriptive about what is going to bring you satisfaction and pleasure and joy as well. And be prepared to find it in unexpected places.
I find you manage it well. I mean, you juggle so many things and I'm like, this guy must have a day that's like 4 times longer than mine.
Right. Well, but that's what I think about everybody else as well. I think a lot of this is perception, you know. Somehow we manage to appear as if we're doing okay. I think if I've learned anything, it's to limit the time I spend wasting time on the internet. that's a massive amount of time. I've tried to be better at that.
Super.
Yeah.
what are you thankful for today?
Oh, goodness. In the age of coronavirus, I have to say I'm thankful for my health and my family's health. I don't know. Is it cheesy to say I'm thankful to have a chance to express love in a way through the work that I do and also my family? I think that's very important. And I'm thankful also just to have, an outlet, a network of people who have those qualities that we've been talking about: imagination, mm-hmm. Sincerity, a desire to try new things, and to sort of remain alive without just getting completely caught up in some kind of hamster wheel of working and sleeping and existing, that, you know, who want to live in a more creative way. I'm thankful to be able to work with those and to have their, you know, support and to be able to support them. All quite sort of corny things, but there we are.
Yes. That's what I'm thankful for. Who and what has played the greatest role in shaping you and what inspires you?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. What has shaped me? I think music, really, and all of the experiences that I've had from the very earliest times that I referred to earlier. I really think of myself as a musician to my fingertips. And that's something that I'm also very grateful for, you know, to go back to your previous question. I remember, you know, when I was at school, other students, you know, they didn't know what they were going to do with their lives. And to some extent, I envied them, but they also massively envied me, because it was as if I had a sort of vocation. And I knew this is what I was going to do. So various people have shaped me along the way, in particular ways, various experiences. But what inspires me is the possibility of getting up in the morning and continuing to explore, you know, this incredible world that we live in, and this incredible feeling of being alive, and to be able to express that.
And what does it mean for you to be true to yourself or authentic in the music business, and how do you keep true to yourself?
We sort of touched on this, haven't we? This notion of sincerity. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, as you get older, you begin to be much more aware of who you are and what is fundamental to you. And again, this is something that I think I've probably always had, and that, you know, people have always sort of discerned in me this sense that, I was me, and that I had my particular interest and my my outlook, which was expressed in composition. I don't know. What does it mean to be true to myself? It's gut instinct, isn't it, really? For example, when you start a piece and you've all sorts of things have come at you from the outside, and you're thinking about all of those, and you're thinking about pieces that you've written before, you're thinking of possibilities, you're thinking of the people that you're going to write the piece for and who they are and the kind of music that they like performing and the kind of things that they're good at or not so good at. In other words, you're engaged entirely with the world, and you're letting it all in, and you're thinking about it, and you begin to work through ideas for the piece, and, you know, you've heard one piece, you know, and you think, quite often I think, oh, I love that piece by X, you know, I'll try something similar in my next piece. Or something like that. You know, we're all influenced the whole time by things, and gradually, what you have to do in order to be true to yourself, as you put it, is to let all of those things kind of percolate through, work through them, do tests, try things out, live with it for a while, imagine. And as being, you know, you sort of project into the future and you say, okay, imagine that was the next piece that I put out. You know, what are people going to make of that? You know, how are they going to see that compared to things I've done before? And all that, all those sorts of things. And you just live with those ideas and you continue to write. Sometimes I try and finish a piece, a draft, then I put it away for ages, then I take it out again. And carry on working on it. And there are moments the whole time where you think, oh, yes, that is what I want to be saying in this piece. In the last week, I've been working on some material about mountains. In fact, it's a piece for mezzo-soprano and piano and tape. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was thinking a lot of you and the piece that we made together, The World in Tune, mm-hmm. Because I've gone back to some of those sorts of materials, that very sort of ecstatic, singing, so I've been working through all these materials, and there comes suddenly a moment where you, as you're kind of trying different things out, you're trying different ways of realizing an idea that you've had, you're trying different combinations of things, you suddenly come across something and you think that is the authentic expression of this piece. That is what I want to to be doing. And it's usually just a moment. It's just, you know, a bit of the, a tiny fraction of the piece, but suddenly you have a vision. Yes, this is it. This is what the piece is going to be. This is where I'm going with it. And then you suddenly realize that everything else you've been doing isn't quite right yet. And so you grab onto the bit that really does work and that you consider to be authentic and, as you say, true to yourself. And then you reimagine everything around it from that focal point. And I find myself doing that a lot. On a micro scale and on a macro scale, there are these kind of moments of realization when you suddenly, you've been working on material for days and then suddenly, yes, finally, it's almost, I tell you what, it's a process of clarifying. It's clarification. Yeah. Everything is obscure to begin with. Like I said, in all these things coming in from light and you don't really know what you're doing and nothing is quite settled in you yet. And then eventually you keep working and you live with it. And eventually you arrive at a clarified version of what you're trying to do. And then, you just know that's it.
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, in whatever I do, what does success mean for you?
Well, finding those moments, writing them down, not ruining the piece, and getting people to play it really nicely or sing it really nicely. I listened to this CD that's going to come out the other day. It's going to come out in a few months, and the record label owner sent me the finished sort of pre-master, and I listened through to it, and that, to me, that was the best moment, because, you know, it had been a very, very hard road, but we'd finally got somewhere that I was completely happy with, and I could listen to it and think, yeah, that is me, and it's done. So you'll notice I haven't said anything about, you know, great career and, you know, massive sort of fame and fortune. I'm less and less bothered with that. I think that's probably kind of normal for everybody, isn't it, as they get older. All I want to do is to continue to have the chance to make work with people, and not just my own work either, but, you know, I want to commission and record work by other people, with Exaudi. You know, I want to conduct performances of wonderful music with wonderful people. Just being busy in the thick of things, doing that would be success.
And is there anything that drives you forward, or do you have a kind of a vision?
I think I'm just naturally driven. I've always been naturally driven. I think that's what people would normally say about me. Whether that's a good thing or not, I'm not sure, but that's just how I am. So
I think it's good. Intrinsic motivation.
yeah, absolutely. It's just a way of being. And I'm thankful for that. That's another thing I'm thankful for, that it just comes naturally.
Well, we're already at the last question, and that is, which tip would you like to give young artists?
Oh, gosh. I'd just say keep going. All of the things that we've talked about, the values behind what we're doing, just keep going. Keep going. Don't be dissuaded. Don't be disheartened. Don't think that what you're doing is pointless, because I think real artists have to keep going, because it's their entire world, it's their value system, it's what makes them happy. So I'd say, you know, these are difficult times. I just say keep, and don't. don't worry if no one's paying any attention. I must say something, Irena, which is that I've never been a sort of famous composer. I was never on those, you know, young composer schemes where you get big commissions from big festivals. I never got into that. I once did the Gaudi Amos Music Week in Amsterdam, and but I never really went for all those things. And so I never became famous as a composer. But I just kept going. And because I had the chance to make the work myself, I found a way to release it. I made CD of it. I put on my own performance of it, and I got people whose opinion I value to come and listen to it. Mm. And just kept going, and I'm still going, and I'm still not really very famous, but I'm more well known than I was, and I've got friends who want to make the work and believe in the work, and I'm just going to keep going. And you know, if I never become that famous, I'll still keep going. Mm. And that's just, you know, just how it has to be. Just keep going.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for this very honest and deep conversations we had. And I wish you all the best for whatever is coming up. And I really hope that we get to see each other again at some point.
I know, absolutely. Me too. I'm sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really hope that you could take lots of inspirations and motivations and ideas for you out of this interview. I'm looking forward to hear from you, get ideas, suggestions, feedback through Facebook or email. I thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I hope that you liked it, and I also hope that this episode has inspired you. It would make me really happy if you could tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.